From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Hello from a rather dreary St. Leonard's. How are you doing? Well, it's the end of the week here. It's Sunday afternoon. I'm probably about to go for a swim. I'm debating whether to or not, but I'm determined not to be a fair weather only swimmer. So despite the rather dreary weather, I think it's important that I go as often as possible because it definitely does help with my mood. Good news on the bets front. Having convinced myself, albeit only very temporarily, that she had some dreadful neurological condition and the loose tooth was only a coincidental problem, I managed to pay more attention to my logical side and waited her out. And sure enough, I was right. The odd reflex reaction that she was having was just a bit of a leftover from feeling those twinges of pain from the tooth, presumably when it just caught and was giving her those little shocks of pain. But after a day or two and insisting on coming for walks, she was right as rain and she's back to her old self now. So that's a big relief. We have tried two backpacks, neither of which worked, and we had to send them back. The first one was a decent fit for me, and I would have been able to carry her weight around quite happily without getting a bad back or sore shoulders. But unfortunately, it wasn't a good fit for her, and her top half was sort of hanging out of the top, and there was just no way it was going to work. The second one was a better fit for her, not perfect, but better, but a really bad fit for me. And just walking around the house for a few minutes, I could feel the strain on my shoulders and my back. So that was a no-go, unfortunately. So for the time being, anyway, we're all just having to be a bit patient and sometimes just leaving her behind if she's still snoring away on the sofa when we manage to sneak out the door. The trouble is when we need to walk a bit faster because we haven't got much time or it's pouring with rain or something like that. So we'll find a balance. I might just have a look at regular backpacks and maybe it would be possible to adapt one. Those are definitely built much more for comfort, so maybe I can make some bets suitable alterations so that I can carry it around if necessary. My run of headaches seems to have almost stopped. They've been a bit hit and miss these last few days, but certainly on the low level side, which is a lot more manageable. I have no idea what caused this latest run. I really don't think it's got anything to do with the glasses, which, to be honest, I'm not getting on awfully well with. The distance ones, certainly, I don't think are going to be something that I can carry on using. The reading ones, I'm still waiting to get back. Those, I'm sure I will use a lot more for working on the computer, because I can definitely feel myself getting eye strain while sitting in front of the computer for a long time, editing and things like that. You can probably hear in the background some of the noises of the local flying wildlife. Those, I believe, are seagulls. I had no idea how noisy it was going to be here. I was not expecting it. The seagulls are so noisy at night, and so are the foxes who scream at each other. I really hadn't expected such a high level of noise in the middle of a town, I have to say. I kind of like it in some ways. They're very seaside noises. Well, not necessarily the foxes, but the seagulls. But gosh, they are noisy, especially so in the middle of the night, it seems. This week's repeat goes all the way back to episode number 4 with Erin McFarland. And she spoke about her long struggle with anorexia and exercise bulimia. And the reason this episode came to mind was an email I got a while after it had been released by somebody who told me how she was listening to it whilst over-exercising herself on a treadmill, and it actually stopped her in her tracks and really made her consider her own life and that she needed to get some help. And it was a good reminder for me of just how important it is to share these stories. As you know, because I've been telling you, I've been struggling quite a bit with my own confidence, self-esteem, I guess, value I offer, or the lack thereof that I guess I feel in my own head. But when I recollect things like that, it's a good reminder that there's always somebody out there who will stumble across these stories and they'll resonate with them and their own lives and maybe help them make a change. So I still definitely feel that Keto Woman needs a bit of a shake-up, and I have been talking with some people about some ideas for a bit of a change-up with some of the episodes, but I still think it's really important to get these personal stories out there. So I'm on the hunt for a fresh load of interviewees, and maybe that's you, or maybe it's somebody you know. So if you want to chat with me here on the show, or you know someone else who might and who we might benefit from hearing their story, just let me know. But for now, back to Erin and her story and my past self as I introduce her. She's another one I think that I need to get back in touch with and have a catch up with what she's doing now, because I know she's gone on to develop her own career to help other people achieve their health and fitness goals. So until next week, I hope you've had a lovely weekend and are heading into next week on a relaxed and positive note. Please take very good care, and I'll see you soon. This week's guest is Erin McFarland. Erin is a 36-year-old mother of two who works part-time for a local food co-op and studied sociology in college. She was diagnosed in March of this year with anorexia nervosa and exercise bulimia and began recovery 6 months ago. Erin is especially keen to share what it's been like to have this disease later in life whilst raising a family. She started keto in 2015 after reading about its ability to improve athletic performance.
She had taken up running after her second child was born, which she now realises was actually a symptom of her already thriving eating disorder. She's keen to share how her eating disorder progressed and why keto affected her body in a negative way at the time, but also how it addressed some health issues that had been bothering her for ages. Once she realised how easily she lost weight while eating keto, Erin had to change her approach to eating this way and manages now to eat a modified version of keto. Hi Erin, welcome to the Keto Women podcast. It's great to be chatting with you today.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Great. Perhaps you could tell the listeners a bit about yourself.
Oh, I'd love to. I am a 36-year-old mother of two. I've been married for 15 years. I was recently diagnosed with anorexia and exercise bulimia earlier this year. And it's centered around the ketogenic diet. And so I'd like to discuss my experience with that and how I've managed my recovery and what my keto looks like now and how it's played a significant role in my life.
Yes, that's great. I think it's something everyone's really generally focused on, losing weight. And I think it's really interesting to talk about the other end of the spectrum. We've been chatting for months and months now, haven't we? On and off.
Yes.
And
yes,
I've been fascinated with your story and the problems you've had. And I think it's really important to share those.
Absolutely.
Perhaps you could mention briefly, just to start with then, what keto looks like now for you, because I know you've been through lots of changes, but what does it look like right now?
Sure. So about a month ago, I've been in recovery for about 6 months. And as soon as my weight became stable, and I displayed all the signs of remission with my eating disorder, I started to transition to a more keto-based diet for the, you know, mental health stability issues, you know, to remedy those, and controlling blood sugar, which I have a family history for type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. So to make sure I keep those in check. Satiety and energy. I have, you know, like I said, two very active children, and so we're very busy. And the benefits that you get from keto are so strong in all of those areas that I feel like I can find an appropriate way to implement that style of eating that also takes into consideration my history with an eating disorder. So about a month ago, I started to implement a modified type keto diet, focusing on, you know, plenty of fat and, you know, fatty protein, fatty meat, vegetables, some fruit, nuts, those types of things. So probably higher carb than you would consider a traditional keto template, but still, you know, well below what a normal standard American diet would look like as far as carbohydrate content.
Mm-hmm. And you're getting enough of the benefits that you found with keto before, even with that. Presumably you need that higher carb level to get enough energy in for you. I know it's very important to keep the calorie level up. And that's one of the ways of doing it, I guess.
Yes. So also making sure that I keep my weight on that I've gained in my recovery, which is quite important for maintaining remission with an eating disorder, is keeping your weight stable and keeping it to a place where the symptoms are not present anymore. So the added carbohydrate also, you know, helps with some, you know, craving issues, because if I tend to go too low in carbohydrate, I can see some pretty strong rebound cravings for, you know, lots of things that may not necessarily benefit me health-wise. So just incorporating things, you know, like dark chocolate and some fruit and some nuts that will satisfy that without having me, you know, like eating a jar of peanut butter every night.
Yeah.
So just trying to take what I've learned through how I, you know, maybe did keto wrong at one point for myself, and also what I've learned through my eating disorder recovery, and putting those together into something that recognizes that I have different needs than somebody who is overweight or has diabetes. My needs are different, and I think keto can definitely still accommodate that.
Which is great. Yeah, it's nice to hear that it can help you, because I know at one time when we were talking, you were... It seemed that you were just going to have to abandon it altogether. And that seems sad when you had seem to get quite a few benefits from it as well. Which came first? Where in your history did keto come as opposed to the eating disorders? How did that play out? Perhaps you could just talk a bit more about when you think your eating disorders started and how it manifested, and just share a bit more about that.
Sure. I'll give a nice like condensed version so I don't like bore people to death. So I had, I was heavier when I was like a preteen. And my family members were all heavier and they went on to develop a lot of health issues. And at that age, I was very uncomfortable in my body. And not that there's anything wrong with being heavier or having extra weight at whatever point. But at that age, I did not have a very strong role model for being comfortable in my body. And as soon as I realized that manipulating my food and my exercise would result in changes in my body, I started, at the time that was back in, the 80s and 90s, cutting all the fat out of my diet, like no butter, no, extra fats, and basically eating, fruit and vegetables and, grains or whatever, because anything that was fat free.
Everything we were told was healthy. Yeah, we were told yes. It was healthy, basically, weren't we?
Yeah. Exactly. And and then I started exercising a lot intentionally, and I did end up losing weight when I was a teenager. And so it started from a young age based on me not having a healthy body image. And of course back then there really was no body positivity movement like there is now, which is becoming very widespread and is wonderful and just helps people accept themselves, and love themselves regardless, because bodies do change and bodies don't always stay the same, and we can't always control our body like we think we can. And so, that sort of started a pattern of being very conscious of my size and what I was eating and trying different regimens. So I was a vegetarian for a long time, and I was a vegan, and I was, I was a variety of weights throughout my life, at some points higher, never like obese, but definitely, on the curvier side. And I was always in the back of my mind, there was that desire to manipulate my eating to result in, the type of body that I was hoping I could get, because I believed that that would solve all my problems.
Yeah, it's funny how we think that, isn't it? And the images we're given, like you say, less so now. There is such a variety now of images of body shapes.
Yes.
But back then, a while ago, it was very much that very slender image was the way you needed to be, and to be healthy and to be beautiful and all the other things.
Yes. Yeah. At any cost, right? Yeah. So there was no account of mental health and how, your mental health might suffer, but, at least you were thin. And so I had two children, and after the birth of my son in 2011, I dropped weight quite rapidly. And at that point, I was eating, I had read the work of Weston A. Price. If anybody, people might be familiar in this community with Weston A. Price. He studied indigenous cultures throughout the world in the early 1900s, and basically came up with the idea that pasture-raised animal fats were crucial to our health and our well-being and our development. So I was kind of in that place of eating a lot of local food, being involved in local, co-ops and CSAs and those sorts of things, and raw milk and all of those things. And so that was sort of how I was eating when my son was born, my second child. And I dropped weight very rapidly after his birth. And I breastfed both my children for an extended period of time. And so that triggered this very most recent severe case of anorexia that I developed. I really want to communicate that I know now, and I obviously didn't know at the time, that when one enters a state of energy deficit through weight loss, exercise, and it could be intentional, unintentional, you could be stressed and, your appetite diminishes and you could lose weight due to that. You could go on a diet and lose weight, but you're entering a state of energy deficit for your body. So that is what triggers the genes for anorexia, for example. And it isn't a disease that somebody chooses. It's oftentimes thought of as being a disease of vanity or people have control issues, but those are all tangential to the fact that you have to have the genetics for these disorders for them to fully develop. And people can engage in, you know, disordered eating patterns or overexercising, but you will only develop a full-blown eating disorder when you have the genetics.
So what you're saying is that you have those genetics already in place. And then when when circumstances led you to lose weight, it triggered the issues that developed. Why do you think you dropped a lot of weight after that pregnancy?
You know, I'm not sure. And like I said, I nursed both of my children, and I had my daughter in 2005, and I nursed her also. After I gave birth to her, and while I was pregnant, I was at a higher weight. And when I had my son, I was at a lower weight, probably a good 30 pounds smaller. And so, you know, everybody kind of has that place where their brain wants them to stay as far as their weight, or I think more accurately, it's a body fat percentage. And so when you drop below that, it can result in some negative health consequences. Not everybody's going to develop an eating disorder when they lose weight, but if you have the genetics, losing that weight or even just engaging in energy deficit generating behaviors like restricting calories, whether intentionally, like I said, or unintentionally, engaging in a lot of exercise can trigger the disorder. And eating disorders, anorexia, is defined by a series of thoughts and behaviors and not by one's weight. So the typical patient, you know, who has anorexia would be a very young, thin, white female who thinks, you know, everybody thinks she just wants to look like a model, or she has control issues, or she has trauma. But the truth is that this disorder affects people of every weight, every gender, every color, every socioeconomic background. And that stereotype of that young, white, thin female is a huge impediment to getting people diagnosed and treated, because the disease is very misunderstood. And I can tell you from experience that when I became severely underweight for my body type, I still was in the quote unquote normal BMI range. I was at the very low end of normal, but I was still normal.
Right.
And when I was very, very ill, my doctor didn't say anything to me, nothing. I had had a period, I had not had a period for 18 months. I was at 6% body fat. Six.
Wow. And I mean, losing your period is a big old warning sign, isn't it? That,
yes.
You know, that's something that should be taken note of, especially by your GP. In association,
she said,
when you put it in association with something like low body fat, surely that should send up warning signals.
Absolutely, but nobody said anything, because I looked very fit because I had really started ramping up my physical activity, which is in itself a symptom of the disorder. The majority of the time when people have anorexia, it's accompanied by an increase in compulsive physical movement, because they believe now that anorexia is an adaptation to flee famine. And so our ancestors, so that this is the reason why it's a genetic illness that's triggered by environmental cues, they believe that this was advantageous to our ancestors at some point when food was very scarce and they needed to migrate to a food source. And so if you think about that, what that may have looked like would have been, even though if you were in a situation of starvation, so low energy stores on your body, low energy stores in your environment, you wouldn't think that your first impulse would be to use even more energy to migrate, right? To move constantly. And so they believe that this is why a lot of people with anorexia, that despite being very thin, oftentimes will have body dysmorphic disorder, because that would have been an adaptive behavior for their brain to convince them that they had enough fat on their body to engage in that migration. And so, you know, oftentimes if you're very thin and you have this eating disorder, you'll think, you would look in the mirror and think, well, no, I'm fat, or I still have fat, or I'm overweight, when in reality you're quite thin. But, you know, in relation to that genetic origin, it would have been advantageous for you to think that you had more fat on your body than you actually do.
Gosh, that's fascinating. So basically what you're saying, it was a survival mechanism.
Yes.
To make you think that you had more energy than you had, but enough to get you to a food source to give you the energy that you needed. So it was, it just meant as a short-term measure, but it's basically a survival mechanism, but it's gone awry.
Exactly.
Because it's been taken to extreme.
Right. And so if you think about, somebody who has anorexia develops an aversion to eating, a fear of eating, and that would have been adaptive and beneficial, because if you had stopped to eat at whatever opportunity, that may have slowed you down and prevented you from finding a place where there was more energy available in a consistent manner, rather than just, you know, stopping for the meantime and refueling. It would have taken away from getting to that ultimate goal of finding a more secure food source. And so you develop this, anybody who's had anorexia will understand the aversion to food that you eventually get to, and eating becomes a terrifying psychologically, which makes no sense, right? Because eating is wonderful and food is pleasurable. But for somebody with this illness, it becomes fearful and to be avoided at all costs. And the, you know, it's like I said, it's accompanied by an uptick in compulsive movement, which makes complete sense based on that genetic evolutionary model.
It does. Yeah. It's fascinating. So when you went to see your doctor, you were aware that something was wrong, or you just weren't feeling good? Why did you go and see the doctor in the first place?
So I went in for a checkup probably about midway into when I really developed this severe case of anorexia. I had no idea that I'd entered into this state. As I said, I had nursed my son, and he weaned when he was about 3. And for some reason, I decided that I wanted to start running. And I have never been like very athletic my whole life. I just, you know, I was very bookish when I was younger, and I live in Colorado, so I would hike and, you know, do yoga and things like that. But running was not something I ever pursued actively. And so I decided I was going to start doing this. And I know now in retrospect that that was a continuation of creating that state of energy deficit that had been triggered by the weight loss from after I'd had my son. And so it makes sense to me now, but at the time I'm like, gee, I think I want to be a runner. So I had started running, and of course I'm very like type A and I'm very competitive. So I said, well, I want to get faster. I want to know how to be faster. Well, I read something. It was the book by the gentleman that wrote the book Born to Run, and it was his second book. And I'm struggling to remember the title of it now. Christopher McDougall is the author. I think that that's his name. So he wrote this book, and in the book he talked about using the ketogenic diet to improve athletic performance. And he was referencing, you know, historical instances of people using that approach and how beneficial it was to their endurance activities specifically, because obviously when you engage in low-level aerobic activity, you're utilizing fat mostly. And of course, I had been fascinated by nutrition my entire life and would read anything I could get my hands on. And as soon as I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I'm like, I'm going to do this keto thing.
Take it to the next level.
Take it to the next level.
Great.
My eating disorder loved that, you know, and at the time I was underweight already. And I didn't know that, of course.
So you were really unaware at this point. You weren't aware of the fact that you had an eating disorder at this point?
Not at all. It took me a very long time to get to that point. So I started doing keto, and of course, I was continuing to run. So of course, I lost more weight. And keto was very like so satiating to me that I would, you know, often do a fasted workout in the mornings, and then I wouldn't eat until probably, you know, 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And I just had no appetite. And I know that part of that, I know now that part of that was my eating disorder, you know, kind of having that aversion to eating. But keto is, it tends to be very satiating for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And that's a benefit for a lot of people who, yes, who need to be restricting, but you were the, yes, the other end of the scale. Yeah.
Yes. And of course, I didn't know that. And I've loved food my entire life. Like, I love to cook. I love to eat. I cook for church. I cook. I mean, I have a baking business. I love food. And so not wanting to eat was very strange to me. And it's not like I've ever had the problem of keeping weight on. I've actually, you know, tended to be a little bit heavier and curvier, you know, most of my life. And so being so lean was very strange to me. And I was actually thrilled with it because, as I said, I'd had that struggle with body image my entire life. And all of a sudden I was very, very thin and I didn't really have to do anything to get there. It felt, everything felt good. And so I had no idea that there was a problem.
You just figured that you were doing everything right.
Yes.
Finally.
Healthy. Right. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is it. Like, I'm healthy. And of course I started telling everybody, like, you've got to try this. And then everybody knew that I was like the keto person and everybody wanted to talk to me about how to do keto and how to be a runner. And so I would just sort of, I just sort of adopted that image of being, you know, the fit mom who did keto. And, you know, I knew all of these, the nuances of how to do it, you know, make sure, you know, you can do fasting and you need a lot of salt and you need to make sure you get magnesium and potassium, you know, all of these things that people just starting, you know, would need to know. And I just got deeper and deeper into this. And I lost my period after, I probably lost about 5 pounds before I lost my period. And I had just gotten it back after nursing my son. I'd only had it for about 3 months and then it was gone again. And then I lost it for about 18 months and I kept doing keto and my, you know, my appetite just kept getting more and more diminished and I got just thinner and thinner. And I'll tell you what, I did get fast, just like that book told me, but I got very sick also. Right. And it really was nothing to do necessarily with me eating a ketogenic diet. It was the fact that I had anorexia and it wouldn't have mattered if I was just eating, you know, potatoes or all mm-hmm. fruit and vegetables. I was ill and I would have lost weight eating those things as well because, you know, that the disorder makes you not eat enough. And so it just so happened that, you know, keto keeps your insulin levels so low and it was like a main line into my body fat stores. And like I said, I would, you know, monitor my body composition at the gym on a pretty accurate machine. And I remember getting to 6% body fat, which is like what male bodybuilders are like in the heat of competition. And they have to work really hard to get there. But for a woman, that's pretty much like death is the next step. My organs yeah. had started shutting down. I had no idea that any of this was happening to me. Like I said, I had gone to the doctor, the GP, for a checkup. And I didn't suspect that there was anything wrong with me. The only thing she ended up telling me was, well, maybe you just have hormonal imbalances because you exercise a lot. She knew I was a runner. My total cholesterol was 330 something. With, you know, super low triglycerides. And so I mean, I wasn't like inflamed and she's like, well, we'll just keep an eye on your cholesterol. And that's all basically she told me.
You didn't feel great, but you didn't feel awful either. So you weren't at that point where you got alarmed yourself, or is that part of the illness that you don't ever recognize it in yourself anyway? Does it always take someone else to bring it home to you? Or how does that work?
That's a great question because there's an actual condition that accompanies a lot of mental illnesses. It's basically that you don't realize that you're sick. And at the time, I felt like I was on, I've never been on drugs, but I felt like I was on some kind of drug because I was so energetic. My mental clarity was so sharp. I just, you know, I felt like superhuman because I could go out and run 10 miles at, you know, an 8 or 9 minute per mile pace and fasted and not have to eat. And you feel like you can do anything. You feel invincible.
Why would you want to lose that?
Exactly. Exactly. And even though you have these sort of inklings that, you know, like I said, you know, my period was gone, I felt so good. And, you know, couple that with all of the positive reinforcement I was getting from other people, you know, oh, you have a perfect body. You are so fit. You look amazing, you know, everywhere you go, because you see these posters, you see the advertisements, and the women essentially look like 12-year-old boys with six packs, you know, and we're like, oh, I look like that. I must be the epitome of health. Nobody tells you that those women are, you know, mentally suffering, that they have no period, that they have osteoporosis, that they have heart arrhythmias, you know, that they're, you know, obsessed with food all the time, that they are freezing. The coldness that I experienced because my thyroid had basically started to shut my entire body down, I would have to sit on heating vents to eat. Like I would sit on the heating vent and crank it up so that I could eat something, because when I would eat it, I would just get so cold.
Wow.
And I remember that, and my hands, my fingers were just splitting open. They looked like the hands of a 90-year-old man. And that was really embarrassing.
But you dismissed all of that because you felt great and you looked great.
Yes.
Or your image of what you thought was great, and everyone was telling you, you know, you look fantastic. So we'll just ignore all those little things that are nagging away that, yeah, it's not quite right, but.
Right. Exactly. And I had, you know, sort of flashes that something was wrong, you know, at various times, but they were so easy to dismiss. And it got to a point where, you know, I was so severely underweight and my digestion was so compromised, and, you know, my thyroid, as I said, had just completely tanked. And so everything was falling apart. My body was falling apart.
Well, it was trying to shut you down, I guess.
Yes.
Let's just shut everything down and conserve what little energy is coming in, because that's all we've got.
Exactly. I was dying a slow death. And I remember being at the gym one day, and I showed this trainer my body composition readout that said I was 6% body fat, and that, you know, I needed to gain, and it would say, you need to gain, you know, X amount of body fat in order to be at the low end of normal. Or it will say, you know, conversely, you know, we suggest you lose 10 pounds of body fat or whatever. And, you know, mine said, you need to gain 20 pounds of body fat to even be considered on the low end of normal. So I showed this to this trainer and I was like, oh my gosh, look at me. Like, I'm 6% body fat. That is amazing. And she just stared at me, and I'll never forget, because if it weren't for her, and this is back to your question about whether this is something that you suspect or you have to hear from somebody else, she just looked at me and said, what are you doing? You could die. Your heart will just stop. And that was so powerful to me because it hadn't even crossed my mind. And I didn't stop at that point. It still took me time to really understand how ill I was, but that her words stuck with me. And it was that like little bird whispering in my ear, just giving me that nudge to be like, maybe you should try to see, you know, that what's happening to you is not healthy. And you know, at some point, you know, I kept going, and the hunger that I experienced was unlike anything I'd ever felt my entire life. I would start binging on first like keto foods, so, you know, keto treats and things like that. And then I remember being so hungry and finally giving into that at, it was a friend's party, and all I did was eat. I probably ate 10,000 calories in a few hours. I mean, and then I like passed out on the couch and went back and ate more. And then I went home and I ate the contents of the cupboard. I mean, it was terrifying, that hunger that you feel when you are so severely malnourished. I can't even describe what that's like. And of course, I had hardly digested anything for, you know, like 18 months. I hadn't doing keto, I was so strict, and I played by every rule that I had read about, because I would read everything and listen to every podcast that I could get my hands on, because I wanted to do it perfectly. I hadn't eaten a carrot for like 18 months, because I'm, oh, it's too much carbs. It's too many carbs. Because a lot of, and this was several years ago. So even that handful of years, you know, there's been so much more information coming out about how to adjust this diet based on your own individual needs. But at the time it was very prescriptive and it was very much for men who were overweight, you know, or people with diabetes. And so telling, you know, somebody who has 200 pounds to lose or is severely diabetic to not eat carrots is maybe appropriate, you know, for a time, mm-hmm. but telling, you know, I'm listening to that and I'm underweight and I'm running 3 hours a day and I can't eat that carrot because there's too many carbs. That I didn't know that there was a problem with that. And so when I started eating again, and it was all the things that my body was just trying to get its hands on because they were full of energy and I just needed, you know, to regain weight rapidly. And my body knew this, but of course my brain was panicked. And,
I was going to say that sounds like a part of your body, its survival mechanism kicking in,
yes.
making you swing from one end to the other end and just saying, causing you, leading you to just eat all the food.
Yeah, you cannot stop it. You know, I've had times in my life where I've, you know, quote unquote, binge eaten emotionally, you know, and it feels so much different than a binge in recovery where your body is so malnourished that it will do what it takes to get that food. And of course, the food it wants is, you know, high carbohydrate, high sugar, high fat, all of those hyperpalatable foods, because it knows that those are going to replenish your stores the most rapidly, obviously, and spiking your insulin. It spikes your insulin, you know, more than anything so that you can regain that weight rapidly. And I really started experiencing those episodes more and more frequently until I got to a point where I was like, well, you know, I think that something is wrong because I can't stop eating huge amounts of food. And then in between, I would feel so guilty and I would go back to trying to do keto. And I did end up regaining some weight. And for a time last year, about 5 or so months, I stopped keto, but I was still implementing restrictive eating habits and I was still exercising quite a lot. And so I regained some weight, but I know now that the eating disorder was still thriving. It was still active, very active. I got my period back for a few months and I became so scared of that weight that I'd regained that I went back to keto last fall, so last September. And, of course, my husband through all this was like terrified because he'd seen, you know, all of these things go down and he almost lost me. I mean, I could have just died and my children almost lost their mom. And, so he was understandably really scared when I went back to doing keto. And, he's an athlete too. He's a triathlete. And so I convinced him to do keto with me last year. And I said, well, it's going to improve your performance and, you know, all of these things. So I did go back to keto last year, and the second time around, I knew that I needed to include more calories, more, you know, more variety, more, just more treats, whatever I needed to do to eat more and not fast as much. And so during that 6 months, I definitely upped my caloric intake. I was eating a lot of chocolate and peanut butter and nut butter and, you know, just the things that were really satisfying, but would still keep my satiety up and keep me from fasting as much. And even despite all that, I ended up losing weight again. and I lost my period again. And so, you know, I remember at the time, like being on the forums and asking people, I'm like, does anybody know like how to do this without screwing your body up as a woman, you know? And everybody's like, well, just eat more fat. I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm eating a lot of fat and I was eating more carbs and I just couldn't keep from losing the weight. And so, I mean, I know that's why how we corresponded back and forth, like it's actually usually a problem that people can't lose weight or they're having a hard time. And I'm like, I can't keep weight on doing this despite eating, you know, a lot of keto treats and a lot of fat and a lot of everything. And so in March of this year, I finally got to a place where mentally I was just spent. I couldn't engage in any kind of restriction anymore. And I know that my body was just malnourished and my brain was malnourished, and it had been through so much over the past few years that, I had to really regain some weight, more than I had before, and figure out what was going on. And it was at that point, after almost 3 years of doing this, that I finally was diagnosed with an eating disorder. And I had to dig so hard to get that information, because I just thought, you know, there's just nothing out there for older women or mothers or people in situations that aren't typical or stereotypical that they associate with having an eating disorder. There's just no resources out there. And it took me a good 2 months and of researching and reading before I really understood what I was dealing with and the severity.
And how did you get to that then? If your doctor hadn't mm-hmm. been any help, where was it that you got the diagnosis and you started getting the help from?
Yeah. So last year, when about spring of 2016, when I had started to eat more and gain a little bit of weight, I came across the work of Matt Stone. If I don't know, there's a lot of people who maybe have heard of him, but he's pretty well known. He wrote some books about diet recovery and basically getting your body temperature back up and correcting thyroid problems. And so that was sort of my first foray into understanding how under-eating and being underweight affected your health negatively. And so from him, you know, I eventually came to, some different resources, like it's called the ED Institute, which is a fantastic resource. And the writer, the researcher, her name is Gwyneth Olwin. And it was her work that really solidified that I needed to go get help. And she was the first place, that I found that acknowledged that people can get eating disorders at any point in their life. You don't have to struggle with them from the time you're, you know, young. You don't have to be a woman. You don't have to be wealthy. You don't have, you know, it can affect anybody. And basically it's this cluster of symptoms, you know, the food aversion, the increase in activity, the focus on food all the time, that defines anorexia rather than just being underweight. And so from there, I came across several different places that really were instrumental in helping me. And I stayed, you know, interested in the keto community. And I didn't really run across this problem very often until I heard a couple of podcasts from some keto-specific women that Leanne Vogel, I think she did an episode on eating disorders. But I still didn't feel like it sufficiently explained what I'd been through and some of the issues. And they didn't really address the origins of eating disorders in a way that I felt like it was appropriate, that a lot of people still present it as something that people choose or that they use to control. And so I really want to get the message out there that this is not a disorder. This is not a disease that people decide to have because it's fashionable or because they want to be thin. Mm-hmm. It's a genetic mental illness, and that everybody deserves to get help, whether you're heavier, whether you're, you know, older, whether you're a man, everybody deserves help with these issues. And so that's been something that I've been really passionate about during my recovery.
I mean, it sounds like you almost really diagnosed yourself and drove your own treatment.
Yep.
What would you suggest for anyone who thinks they might be in a similar position? If what you're saying is sending off alarm bells in their minds, what should they do? You know, if they can't necessarily repeat what you did to heal yourself mm-hmm. themselves, what should their first step be?
I suggest there are some really good questionnaires online, like the ED Institute. I mentioned them, and they're going to have, you know, lists of resources where people can access those, whether remotely or in their community. And they can get an idea based on those questionnaires of if this is something that they need to seek help for, which if you even suspect, you know, to a small degree that you have these, get help because it can become very serious. And eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. And that can be the result of starvation or suicide. And they're very serious. And I remember when I was so emaciated, all I could think at that point when I was so depleted was, I wish I could just starve myself to death. I wish I could just starve. I just would give anything to stop this. And even at that point, it still didn't sink in that this was something I needed to get help with. And it really angers me that our culture propagates disordered eating and body image at every turn for every marketing, you know, opportunity. And it just drills in more and more that this is normal, that it's normal to torture yourself, that it's normal to punish yourself, that you need to be suffering. And it's not. And not everybody is made to be a size zero. Not everybody is made to weigh 120 pounds. We are, you know, we are made in a variety of sizes, and that is okay. And, you know, you can address health issues in a way that's appropriate to your physiology without harming yourself. And so that's kind of where I'm at now with keto is I think it can be very helpful for people if they have a history of eating disorders in certain circumstances done appropriately. But for others, it may not be appropriate, and that's okay. And it needs to be something that people can understand. They can interpret it however they need to for their specific body and their health needs and their health history.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, you may not lose weight doing keto, and that may not necessarily matter, but maybe it mitigates some of the other health concerns or the mental clarity issues or mental health issues that you struggle with. And that's fantastic. You know, the marker of success for something doesn't have to be, well, did I lose 20 pounds? So now I can, you know, fit into my old clothes. That's unrealistic. And I think it does more harm than good because I believe that this way of eating can help. I know if my grandmother had been exposed to this, or if I could have helped her, you know, she wouldn't have gotten diabetes. She wouldn't have had breast cancer. She wouldn't have got, you know, those are horrible illnesses, and I've witnessed them firsthand, and they impacted me so much that, you know, I decided I would do whatever I had to do to never have that happen to me and my family. And, you know, I don't think it's appropriate to make decisions out of fear, but it certainly is something that concerns me that I have that family history. But I also have a history of anorexia. So I need to balance those in an appropriate way that respects the fact that that's my genetic makeup. And I think that there's a way to do that, that I can eat this way for the rest of my life and mitigate all of those concerns to the best of my ability. Of course, you can't control everything, but, you know, so you need to be reasonable, but yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at now.
I think it is easy enough to take the ethos, take the foundations that you learn when you get into the ketogenic community, but then apply them to yourself, whatever that means. And it might mean a higher carbohydrate level. It might mean a higher protein level. It might mean all sorts of things.
Yes.
But you just start at the starting point, and then you adapt it to suit yourself, because we're not all the
yes.
same. And it's crazy to think that one method, one way of eating is going to work for everybody, because it just simply can't.
Absolutely. And I'm so happy to see how much progress has been made in the past few years in this community in regards to that, because, you know, women like you and, you know, the Keto Dudes and some of the other podcasts that are coming up, and there's like the To It Nutrition, Amy Berger, she's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Break Nutrition, that's a great website. And just having a broader view of how this can be applied in all of these different scenarios, because whenever I came to it, it was very prescriptive and there weren't a lot of nuances. And I remember listening to like Jason Fung, and he was like, fasting, fasting, fasting. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I should fast. I have literally 5 pounds. I have 5 pounds of body fat on my body, but I should fast. And it was like, I couldn't find anything that said, you should not fast if you're underweight, or, you know, it was just like, yes, categorically, everybody should fast. And so now I've heard a lot more people, you know, chime in and say, actually, you should not fast if you're underweight or if you have anorexia, or, you know, making all of these caveats. So I'm very happy to hear that out there, because it was not out there whenever I first started this. So that's a great development.
Right. Yeah. With everything, there's a spectrum, and you just have to find where you fall.
Yeah. I make the analogy that whenever I started keto, the thought of like, including more carbohydrate would be like going vegan and having some bacon now and then, you know, it's like, to me, I was like, that's anathema. Like, you don't do that. You can't eat fruit. But of course, you know, keto is a little different template than veganism. And so I think there's more flexibility to it than people might perceive there to be.
So, yeah, so it's really interesting how you've dipped in and out of keto, but you have held the belief that it is good for your health and your mental health and your well-being, but you've just had to find a way to apply it to you and to keep you healthy and with balance with the eating disorder history.
Yeah,
as well.
I had to really hit rock bottom before I figured that out. So I'm hoping that other people can learn from my experience and don't have to suffer the ill consequences of not eating enough. So, you know, and that's really important because it is so satiating, and just making sure that they monitor themselves for the potential negative health consequences that can result from, and people don't always think that being in a bigger body could result in some of these same symptoms, but they absolutely can, because your genetics may say, you should weigh 200 pounds. And for some people, that's what they're going to weigh. And if they stray from that, they're going to start to see, you know, the thyroid shutting down and the coldness and the, you know, the lethargy and the obsession with food. And so some of those things that I experienced during my eating disorder can absolutely happen to somebody in a larger body. And that's very important to recognize and to respect and then to correct. You don't need to punish yourself because your genetics say you need to be at a higher weight. There is nothing inherently wrong with that, as long as your health markers, you know, you're keeping the inflammation in check and processed foods out of your diet and your blood sugars are good and your insulin levels are good, then, you know, weight is not inherently a problem. It's at that point, you know, more of a vanity issue of, well, I wish I could weigh 150, but your body may not really want you to be at 150. And in order to get there, you really may have to suffer.
No.
So it's important that we understand that everybody is built differently and that that's okay.
And presumably, you know, if you get a feeling that some of these things affect you and you look at some of the resources that you've mentioned, and we'll put in the show notes, if you were to then go to your doctor armed with that, they're going to be much more likely to start thinking in the eating disorder mindset, assuming that they wouldn't before, because of course some would have picked it up where they didn't with you.
Yes. And actually, I didn't mention that was my GP that I'd seen for a long time that I initially went to. And then since I live in Denver, I'm lucky enough to be very close to Dr. Jeffrey Gerber's office. And he's a very well-known low-carb doctor. And so I went to his office for a checkup, and they were there. His assistant, the PA, Erin Kay, she was the first medical professional to say, you need to gain weight. This is a low carb doctor's office. She said, you need to go home and eat carbohydrates. That's what you need to do, and stop exercising. This is coming from a low carb doctor, you know, and I was like, what? I'm like, they don't know what they're talking about. Like, what does she know? Like, she obviously doesn't do this right, you know, because I was still like very much in my eating disorder mindset. And so she was the first one who actually said, you are not in good health. You need to gain weight. And she didn't specifically say you have an eating disorder, but she was the first one to advocate that I needed to gain weight. So that was really surprising. And I have to give props to them because they knew what they were talking about.
But really, yeah, the ultimate power is arming yourself with the information and the knowledge and driving your own treatment if you
Absolutely.
Possibly can. But as you pointed out, it so often takes somebody else to kickstart it, somebody else to scare you so much into thinking, hold on a minute,
yes.
I've got to make changes
yes.
and I've got to go out and get this information. But often you really need that
Absolutely.
Kick up the arse to make the change.
Yeah, unfortunately. And even when my husband, you know, my daughter would look at me and say, Mom, you're too skinny. You know, and my husband, of course, I looked like a skeleton with muscle. I mean, I was incredibly thin. And even, you know, those comments, still, it didn't click. And I believe it has so much to do with the fact that we worship thinness in our culture. And so that social approval almost overrides those voices that you might hear from inside saying, there's something wrong. Everywhere you look, it's like, no, lose weight, get thinner. Thinner is better, get fitter, run more, eat less, you know. And even though those don't cause eating disorders by any stretch of the imagination, they certainly are an impediment to recovery. And so it's very difficult to live in a culture where the prescriptive behaviors almost mimic what the eating disorder is telling you. It's very disturbing. Rather than looking at these more global issues as far as health is concerned, it's so focused on weight. And that's really disturbing.
Gosh, well, this has been fascinating. And I'm so happy to see you back to health now. You know, as we said before, mm-hmm. I've been chatting to you for a while, and I've seen some of the struggles that you've gone through. And it's a joy to see that you found a balance now and finding a way to be happy and healthy again.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I'm very stubborn and I'm very inquisitive. And if I want to know something, I'm going to know everything about it, because then that means I can help other people. And so I've really tried to use this experience to correct places where I think people are maybe erroneous in their thinking, and try to shed more light on these issues, because I think it's more prevalent than people want to admit. And I know that there are women listening to this that have the exact same struggles as me, and they may not want to admit it because it's terrifying. It is terrifying. But I can attest to the fact that once you allow your body to heal, it's unlike anything. Freedom is unlike anything you can imagine. And it is worth all the struggle to get to the other side. And I'm grateful just to be here and be alive, because I very easily couldn't have been. I could have died through all that. And I really want women especially to know that. And it's okay to get help.
It certainly is. And so, just to wrap up a little segment I'm putting at the end of the show, just to offer, what would be your top tip to the listeners?
Sure. My top tip would be to listen to your body and your mind, and to do what's right for you, that you know is right for you. And if you suspect that something isn't working for you, learn more about it. Learn how you can address those concerns. Understand what your goals are and why you have them, and adjust them as they don't work for you anymore. And, you know, our bodies don't stay the same. Our needs don't stay the same throughout our entire life. They change from day to day, month to month, year to year. And that is okay. And it's okay to have to adjust. You don't always have to do things the same. And you don't have to do things like everybody else. And whatever your needs are, they're perfectly valid. And you're the only one who knows what's right for you. So listen to that, because it will give you a better outcome than listening to a doctor or an expert any day. And it might save your life.
Perfect. What fabulous advice. Well, thank you so much, Erin, for talking to me today. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Wow, it's an honor. I've loved this conversation. I appreciate it.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to www.ketowomanpodcast.com. Do you want to be one of my extraordinary women? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and help create new shows, head over to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman, where you can make a monthly contribution. You can also simply hit the support button on the website. It's thanks to the two keto dudes that I'm hosting this podcast, so please consider heading to their Patreon page at patreon.2keto.com and help them bring you more podcasts like this one. This week's quote is from Janine Roth. Change happens when you understand what you want to change so deeply, there is no reason to do anything but act in your own best interest. Bye bye, keto lovelies.